And I think I was coming at it from a skeptic viewer that what does skin microbiome do? And we did epithelial transcriptomics on mice that are germ-free or notobiotic mice, which they're raised in absence of microbiota, compared to conventional mice which have an intact endogenous microbiome. And I performed an epithelial transcriptomics study. And what shocked me was I was expecting I would see the immune signatures as had been seen prior. And it shocked me that the genes we actually saw different in the top lists were epithelial development, epithelial stratification and differentiation. And that to me was the first hint that, oh, this microbiome is an active player in regulating skin function.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a nonprofit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series, Exploring the Skin Microbiome. In this series, we speak with experts about some of the latest advances in our understanding of the microbial communities of the skin, including progress towards clinical interventions in dermatology.
Hi, everybody. My name is Colin Hill.
And I'm Dan Tancredi.
And our guest today, we're delighted to welcome Ayushi Uberoi, who is at the very famous WashU School of Medicine. And we're delighted to have her here because she's talking about a very, very interesting topic, and that's the skin and the skin microbiome. So, Ayushi, let me start with a really stupid question, and then you can tell me how stupid it is. Proper skin is completely impermeable. It's like a raincoat that covers the surface of our bodies, and there's no interaction with the outside environment at all. How badly am I wrong in that statement?
I think, first of all, not at all a stupid question. Most people forget the skin, so you have skin in the game here. So that's all great. I think how I would say it is it's a barrier for the internal organs. I'm not going to go so far as to say that it's an impervious raincoat, which absolutely does not interact with the outside environment. I would say it's a very reactive barrier, and it's that reaction or the immune responsiveness and the immunity which does control the underlying parameters. So I think it's a reactive interface, but it does, because of it, how good the skin barrier is, it's going to protect the underlying organs.
And I presume different areas of the body have different skin types. I mean, some may be much more reactive than others. Some are open, of course, with sweat glands and maybe things like that. Others are more coated with perhaps dead skin cells and things like that. Are there regions of the body which are far more interactive, let's say higher levels of immune cells or something?
I don't think we necessarily know that to the degree that I would be comfortable making that claim. But what we know histopathologically very accurately across many studies, not just in biology, but even in collaborations with anthropology departments and so on, that the skin of different parts of the body is very different. What is common and what is beautiful is it's a stratifying epithelia. So what happens is you have a basal layer and then it commits to terminal differentiation. And I think where the different sites vary is in how much stratification is there and how many stratified layers would be there. So conceptually, it's a stratified epithelia. And then I guess where the other sites do differ is the skin integumentary system, as you were referring to. So the eccrine glands or the apocrine glands, those would be different in different regions. There would also be sebaceous glands, which would be different. And importantly, what has been studied beautifully by several skin biologists is also the hair follicle niche, which is actually composed of very unique populations of cells, in fact, forms like a regenerative stem cell layer. So I think that's how they're different. Maybe because of those associated integumentary systems, one can anticipate a different immune reactivity. I am not confident making the claim that we know that. But with this tied is also a complexity, which is the nutritional landscape. So, for example, some of these areas, because of what kind of stratification is happening, may be more lipid rich, may have more calcium fluxes, may have different ionic channel gradients. But what would be common to all of them, regardless, would be there will be a stratification, which I think is the most fascinating thing about the skin.
Can you tell us how the skin microbiota looks like? How do we know that it helps us? How does it differ from what we're more familiar with in the gut and other microbiota?
So skin microbiome is relatively new in the game compared to gut microbiome. But decades of work from very seminal scientists, a lot of it led by biologists like Julie Segre, who leads the Human Microbiome Project and focused a lot on skin microbiome, and also work from dermatology and biologists like Rich Gallo, who've studied the immune system and so on in the skin. Here's what we know. The skin microbiome is very different than the gut microbiome, presumably just because of the fact that it's a more exposed niche. But then the other aspects that come to it is it's a nutrient sparse niche. Yeah. So it's not like, so it's can be sometimes equated to a sandy desert. And I think that's what also makes it very fascinating, that what are the microbes that can colonize and live on such kind of a barrier. So these are very different microbes compared to the gut systems. And presumably, if we go down to fundamental biology, how they would be grown in different environments would also affect their biology. And what was the case was that for the longest time, I think people just thought that the skin microbiome is unique, very cool. It seems to be different at different sites, like forehead is completely different than what we see on the arm. Is it a passive observer? Like, is it just there? Is it just chilling out? Like, what is it doing? And I think very seminal work from Yasmin Belkid's lab, led by Shruti Nayak, actually showed that the skin commensal microbes, as they're sometimes referred to, elicit very unique immune responses, which now those labs had studied the biology even more, that they even have systemic responses and they're very unique to the skin. And I guess from my personal experience, I trained as a cancer biologist and I was studying skin cancer, and I was fascinated by the microbiome, and I joined my postdoc lab in Elizabeth Grice's lab, who was also responsible for leading the Human Skin Microbiome Project. And I think I was coming at it from a skeptic viewer that what does skin microbiome do? And we did epithelial transcriptomics on mice that are germ-free or notobiotic mice, which they're raised in absence of microbiota, compared to conventional mice, which have an intact endogenous microbiome. And I performed an epithelial transcriptomics study. And what shocked me was I was expecting I would see the immune signatures as had been seen prior. And it shocked me that the genes we actually saw different in the top lists were epithelial development, epithelial stratification, and differentiation. And that to me was the first hint that, oh, this microbiome is an active player in regulating skin function.
The work you did with Elizabeth Grice was really amazing. Can you talk to us about the development of the model, the notobiotic model?
Of course. So the story really had started with this fundamental axis that what do commensal microbes do to the skin? And we found the observation that I just described to you, that we found through epithelial transcriptomics that there were differentiation genes altered. And then in that story, we followed what could be a possible host mechanism. And what was very interesting was that we found that the xenobiotic receptor, aryl hydrocarbon receptor, which is an extremely promiscuous and very important receptor because it detects all external signals. So it has been classically studied in the liver as a detoxifying enzyme. And we found that one of the mechanisms by which this barrier function is regulated is through this receptor. And that leads to development of this model that, okay, cool, how does it work? So we wanted to find what are the specific ligands or metabolites that activate this receptor. And a lot of effort has been made in the gut microbiota field to study synthetic microbial communities and use them as tools for translational and fundamental biological observation. But no such tool existed which was unique for the skin microbiome. So there have been efforts in curating and isolating skin microbes, but those microbes, as I began, are completely different from the gut. And we had to take a very high task tour de force in the lab, in which a lot of healthy humans were swabbed. And here's the thing. It was very easy to find staphylococci, because thanks to beautiful microbiology work, we know how to isolate staphylococci. But what about other microbes? So we basically came up with a strategy in which we used about 15 different kinds of media, and then we isolated all as much complexity of the microbiome we could capture. So we brought our model to 50 unique species. What I'd like to focus on is this is an aerobic-rich microbiome. And we did not focus on anaerobes, which is its own area which one can explore. But for the purpose of starting somewhere, we focused on the aerobic microbiome. And then we colonized notobiotic mice or germ-free mice with these microbes, which is probably the hardest experiment I've ever done, because all these 50 microbes have their own moods and whims. They grow the way they want. They all grow in very different medias. So they had to be grown up, CFU counted, and biobanked. And then the experiments had to be done with colonization.
I think so. It's fascinating that, you know, you tried all the different kinds of media to see what will thrive on what, because it is a desert, like you said. The skin doesn't have the kind of root resources. Now, you're making contrast with the gut, but the aerohydrocarbon receptor is also important for barrier integrity in the gut, too.
Exactly.
So it's really remarkable work. It's really exciting.
But explain to me, Ayushi, please, and just paint a picture if you can. I mean, I'm a gut microbiologist, so I can understand how a bacterium sitting on or very close to a single layer of epithelial cells in the gut, which are moist and living and replicating, can transmit a signal. And immune cells, of course, can stick out through this epithelium, and you can get endocrine cells and enteric nervous system all kind of out there on the surface. But in the skin, you're talking about the stratified layer, maybe with almost dead cells or heavily keratinized cells on the surface. If I'm a bacterium sitting out there, how am I communicating with systemically to the whole human host?
So the dream experiment, which we haven't done yet, is what we don't know and we cannot control for in these experiments is if the bacteria which we colonize the mice with on the skin, where it is translocating to. But if I don't get into that specific technicality, how I think the communication is happening is through metabolites. And in my study, I think what was a little different than what people had done in the past was that we did skin metabolomics. And we found that tryptophan metabolites, which had been also found in the gut to regulate aryl hydrocarbon receptor and barrier, I was actually surprised at how much tryptophan was in the skin itself. And then we found tryptophan metabolites in the skin as well. So that precedence for that came from a study in atopic dermatitis, in which people had done patch stripping and they had done metabolomics on the patches, and they had found that atopic dermatitis skin is often deficient in tryptophan metabolites, which is why we went down that path. Like, there was a way to think about things, but where those tryptophan, how is that being synthesized? At this point, we haven't teased apart the entire bacteriology, but in my study itself, what we did find was when we mined those genomes and did genome analysis, we do see tryptophan metabolizing enzymes also enriched in the skin microbes.
What it's about is how active are these microbes? I mean, you can imagine an E. coli in the gut maybe replicating every 30 minutes or an hour, maybe, you know, doubling time of that kind or generation time of that kind of order. But I'd imagine a bacterium sitting on this desert, as you describe it, with very low nutrient, under a lot of stress. What's the doubling time, the generation time? How actively metabolizing are these bacteria?
So in vitro, they're very prolific. In vitro, the doubling times would be very comparable. Like if you grow a Staphylococcus species in lab, it's going to be very comparable to E. coli, maybe lesser. But I think what you're asking is what would be the doubling time on the skin itself? So we don't know that precisely, but what I can tell you is that not only did we do sequencing to see what communities colonize, we also did plating off our microbiota to capture the live bacteria. And we do capture a pretty high amount. Like if you take a skin swab from a mouse and plate it, you are going to get about 10 to the 5th CFUs per gram of skin. What I can tell you is we have tried to mimic in our lab, and some other labs have also done this, in which we have made media that can recapitulate some of the chemical environments of the skin. For example, Alexander Horswell's lab has made a skin-like media which mimics the skin chemical structure. And then Lindsay Kalin's lab has made sweat and sebum medias, which has also been used in Julie Segre's lab to study Staph epidermidis biology. We know for a fact that these different medias slow down the bacteria. So I think in terms of even the doubling times that we recover, they would be log folds lower than what we get in a traditional rich media. But I cannot think off the top of my head if someone has done the experiment that you said, but I think it's fascinating. Maybe I will get someone to try it. Like, we have some skin mimics in the lab. We could try something like that.
Cool. And a follow-up question is, you know, these bacteria, they're growing on the skin, they're present on the skin, maybe not in the same kind of numbers as they are in the gut, where we can get 10 to the 12 per gram of eating, things like that. What, it's, if somebody cares about their skin microbiome, how can they protect it? I mean, are things that we would recommend for hygiene purposes, washing and using soap and water and hot water, do you think these can be deleterious in terms of your skin microbiome? Or is your skin microbiome almost impervious to that type of washing and hot water and so on?
So very important question, and that is something we think about in the lab a lot. I think if we go by scientific precedence, in the studies that have been done on longitudinal sampling of the skin microbiota, which has been done in Julie Segre's lab, a lot of the skin microbiome is extremely stable. So these would be individuals who are swabbed over a period of 12 months with routine functions. So it seems that even if it's perturbed, it does come back to a basal state. Now, I think in that maybe there are some aspects to the study design which one would have to consider. From my perspective, there are also studies. So both aspects, I think, could be happening. I think the different products, the hygiene products, et cetera, that we apply, they could be deleterious, because what we know from some studies is a lot of the compounds which are present, say, in active sunscreen, they can actually inhibit the growth of microbes. There have been some studies that have looked at some of these products. It has also been studied a lot in the gut that a lot of the different exposures affect how gut microbes grow. But there is another aspect to it, which I have been thinking about, that because the skin is such a nutrient-sparse location, and some of these, this is a low biomass burden site. We never recover the same biomass as the gut, yet with very profound implications, at least for the immune system. It is also possible that some of these products, especially like those which are used in cosmetics, as well as like just carrier products, which are used to deliver topical medicines, they could be used as carbon sources as well, which could allow the microbiome to change. Now, if we match that with the historically precedent longitudinal studies, it is possible that it comes to a stable configuration. But I guess that would come to the question which plagues the microbiome field in general. Like, what is a healthy basic microbiome? Like, if someone's applying the same products every day, maybe their basal state is different. So I think that just points out further this gaping hole in the field overall, that what is a basic healthy microbiome? But I think both things could be happening. They could be deleterious, like topical drugs and so on might directly be interacting with the bacterial replication machineries. But I also think there's a possibility that some of these pollutants and so on, which have carbon sources within them, could just be carbon sources for the bacteria. So I don't have the answer yet, but maybe in 5 years we'll have some more concrete information.
Your research is awesome. You've also kind of given tips to other scientists about understanding the research techniques for the skin microbiota. Can you talk to us a little bit about that in particular? I'm thinking about the proclivity to environmental contamination because of the low biomass site. So how skeptical are you when you read literature in the skin microbiome field? Do you sort of feel like you need to know how good a particular lab is at collecting their specimens or not? Or
I don't know if it's like lab specific or anything, but I read every study like a scientist, like what are the controls? what are the interpretations. So I can walk you through some of the considerations that we incorporate in my lab. So for example, if we were doing an experiment where we want to collect a skin swab from a mouse, this is what we would do. Besides just collecting the skin swab from the mouse, we will also swab the cage, the bedding, which you would also see in my paper is there. And then we also wave the swab, which people find really funny, but we also wave the swab in the hood where we're doing the work that, you know, what if something is there?
Right.
And then that's one part of the collection. I will be honest, I sometimes don't know if you see something, what that means. I will come to that in a bit. But those would be the essential items I will collect from every experiment. So that would...
You also get negative controls. And I'm not a microbiologist, but I couldn't imagine. What would a negative control look like? Is that... What would Graham look like?
So then this is just the layer of sample collection. But now I think the real challenge comes in actually doing the sample prep, which is extracting the genomic DNA. So we got to appreciate that this is a low biomass burden sample, which is highly susceptible to contamination. So in my lab, and this I have inherited from my postdoc mentor, so I imagine that this is something we all have thought about very actively. So in our lab, we have dedicated metagenomic hoods, which are only for low biomass sample collection. Some people often make fun of my lab that why is your lab always wearing PPE and everything? And I'm like, well, we're going to get contamination. But when we do those extractions, we absolutely have to have a negative, like a no swab extraction control, a blank swab extraction control. And this really comes from work from Rick Bushman's lab. So I think these debates were raised a lot that is their placental microbiome. And I think what has been recognized in the last few years is something called a kit-ome, that a lot of the kits that we use, they do have residual contamination, which is picked by all these very sensitive next-generation sequencing techniques. So I think having all these samples, I have a little more confidence in interpreting what we see. So even before we do thresholding, I like to just see the data when it comes from the sequencer. We also have like a few blank water controls to see if like something is being carried off. So those are some experimental considerations. I guess the hard part is this, that I told you we collect environmental samples, we collect bedding samples and so on. I guess the hard part is, does one take those out of the analysis? Like, is that supposed to be a threshold for just eliminating everything that we see? I think some for the rules of microbiome researchers are applicable. Like it would be unlikely that chloroplast, which is from the food, is going to be on the skin. So I think those would be thresholds that would be eliminated immediately. But I think the practice that I took and we have tried to follow, at least in my prior papers, is we just report the data as it is. That I think the community should also see what we're seeing. One of the challenges I had was, if you swab a germ-free mouse, what are you going to see if you sequence it? Because the sequencer is going to sequence something. So some of those are very difficult to interpret. But I would think those would be difficult to interpret in microbiome overall. And I guess that's where the control of the rigor of the research does depend on what controls there are. Where I can believe the findings that we have is because it's not just the sequencing that we've relied on. We do metabolomics. We see phenotypic function, which is why in the papers we have used several techniques to test our hypothesis. So I think that's the thought I was coming from. And I guess the one aspect which I can definitely say, like where one can get confused about interpreting skin microbiome data, and not just skin microbiome, I think many other microbiome data, is this bug called Cutibacterium acne. So sometimes you will see it show up in different sites where it should not be. And I genuinely think it's because it's coming from the handling, because we are covered in Cutibacterium acne. And I think it like sheds during the procedures. So maybe even like how the DNA prep is done is very, very critical and should be done with as much sterile technique as possible. So I think if I was to say, like, sometimes when I get suspicious of some things, it will be like, why is there Cutibacterium acne in a marine microbiome study? But I guess, like, that's why we have to match the metagenomic studies with culturomics as well.
And are there learnings from the gut microbiome where people have developed a lot of intervention? They sometimes call them the biotics family of probiotics, prebiotics, postbiotics, symbiotics. Are there, I mean, I know there are skin probiotics that are marketed, but do you think there's room for things like skin prebiotics where you deliberately put some kind of carbohydrate source or protein source on the skin to promote the growth of beneficial bacteria? And I say beneficial within inverted commas, but, you know, bacteria that we believe play a beneficial role. Are people looking in that kind of direction, guided maybe by some of the work that's gone on in the gut microbiome?
So I think the gut microbiome field is just a knowledge source for any microbiome that we are studying, because I think the gut microbiome field has made so many leaps forward in educating us about different models and how to even make some interventions. Where I think there's a gap, which is great because there's so much more to learn, we don't really know much about the nutritional needs of the skin microbes as we do for the gut microbes. And I think there is an entire opportunity to explore those. I think if we had better idea, we could build more guided prebiotics, as you described. I think what we do have knowledge about is some of the ceramidases and the fatty acid synthesizing kind of bugs. And I think that those studies have been done by several leaders in the field. But I don't think even they have gone into like what nutrition source can be used. Most studies have been on what can the skin microbe produce. So I think there is a huge amount of work that needs to be done. And that's great for young researchers. You come study a new microbiome system.
Well, I think it's just the most fascinating area that you're working in with so many challenges, but as you say, then so many opportunities and so many rewards for people who are willing to put in the hard work. So Ayushi, thank you so much for sharing your enthusiasm for this area with us. And we wish you every success in your future research.
Well, thank you so much. It was super fun talking to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.